The Obama Legacy, Predicting What History Will Say About the 44th President of the United States. Some might call any exercise to forecast a president's legacy a fool's errand, but that's not going to stop us. As the president prepares to deliver his final State of the Union address tonight, political observers will be eager to respond and offer their own take on how history will look back upon the Obama presidency. Will he be remembered primarily as the first African-American president, or will his legacy be the Affordable Care Act? Some will say the president failed to fulfill the expectations of his core supporters. Others will argue a GOP-controlled Congress thwarted many of his initiatives. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we'll explore what the Obama legacy might look like and what to expect in his final 12 months in office. Main Calling asks, how will history look upon the Obama years? First, this news. From the MPBN studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Main Calling. President Obama delivers his final State of the Union address this evening. He's expected to highlight accomplishments of his administration rather than put forward many new initiatives for his final year in power. Today we're going to look ahead to how history might remember the Barack Obama presidency. With me in the studio, Andrew Rudalevich. He is the Thomas Brackett Reed Professor of Government at Bowdoin College. Glenn Cummings is the president of the University of Southern Maine. He served as President Obama's education in the Department of Education as a deputy secretary. And joining us from the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C. is James Thurber. He's a distinguished professor of government and founder and director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. He's the author of numerous books, his most recent, American Gridlock, The Sources, Character, and Impact of Political Polarization. Thank you all for joining us today. As always, we want to hear from you as well. What do you think that President Obama's legacy will be? Our phone number, 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, or tweet at Main Calling, or post to the Main Calling Facebook page. We'll get to the Obama presidency and some specifics about that. But first, I wanted to talk a little bit about this art of forecasting legacy. As we said at the top, some might describe it as a fool's errand, because really, by definition, you need the lens of history to create legacy or to define legacy. But Glenn Cummings, let's start with you. What's your take on how legacy can be predicted?
Well, it is somewhat subjective, and it, as many have pointed out, sometimes the person on the street may have a different sense of what legacy is than, say, historians. That said, usually what happens with historians, we see the question coming up, what kind of influence does it have several generations? Does that presidency have several generations down the line? Does it make a difference in how the party is viewed, of the political party of the president? Does it make a difference in terms of the way in which America views itself? And I think those are certainly a criteria that we see among political science and historians in general.
Andy Rudalevich, is it really about letting some time pass or generations pass before we get a true look back on how a presidency is seen?
Well, certainly most presidents are relatively unpopular when they leave office, it seems to me. And this is something that does change over time as we get a clearer historical record. Think of Harry Truman, right, who was incredibly unpopular, approval ratings in the 20s as he left office in the cloud of Korea and the idea of China lost to communism and corruption in the administration. And now, number of decades later, he's seen as a great president, decisive, made key decisions at the right time in the Cold War that have been impressive. So not surprisingly, when George W. Bush was leaving office in 2008, people would ask him, what do you want your legacy to be? And he'd say, that's for the historians to decide, but you might want to look at Truman.
James Thurber, is history then generally good to presidents as we, in terms of their legacy?
Well, I think presidents' reputation gets better over time, but it depends to a great extent on the problems facing America when a president comes in and whether the solutions the president comes up with with Congress or alone, have actually solved some of those problems. The economy and war are two major phenomena that really undermine a president or help a president. Let's take LBJ. He did a great deal for civil rights in the war on poverty, but the war really undermined him, and he was unpopular when he left. He was unpopular with respect to foreign policy, defense policy, but I think in terms of the education reform, in terms of Medicare, Medicaid, the Voting Rights Act, and those are historic things that he did that really changed America. So look at what a president does and how long it lasts. Now, certainly FDR did a great deal also that dealt with major problems, crises, and the solutions that he had lasted. So I think that has a great deal to do with the president. What a president does after he leaves office also is very important. Carter was very unpopular. We had inflation going on, and we also had the failure of dealing with Iran and the prisoners there in our embassy. But after his presidency, he's really has a very good reputation for what he's done internationally for elections and helping people of nations that have a great deal of poverty and other actions.
Are there other factors, do you think, though, that over time may change the way that legacies are created? I'm thinking about the 24-hour news cycle, social media, the way that that every word is captured, the way that viral conversations go nationally. Glenn Cummings, may that change the traditional way that legacies are created simply over time?
Yeah, I think that's very possible. And certainly our ability to document and record the pieces of the presidency, the micro pieces of a presidency today are much more visceral, much more hands-on, that we can see things that we couldn't have seen in a Kennedy White House or we couldn't have seen in an Eisenhower White House. So I think to that extent, historians will have more material, more soil to dig into perhaps than they would have normally. And that may ultimately influence how a president is perceived.
Yeah. Andy?
Well, I would say that it's possible, though, that a lot of this will turn out to be sort of the temporary flame in the sense that we do know a lot more, clearly. We'll have a huge amount of material to go through as future historians go through the present day. But I wonder how much of that will be seen as sort of more heat than light. As you go back to the archives, right, I think going back to what Jim Thurber said, looking at what changed structurally in a policy sense is going to be pretty crucial and how long-lasting that is. What changed in terms of public attitudes? You know, how did people see the government, see the role of government, see the role of the United States in the world? You know, those things I think are probably longer-lasting. I would add, too, that we do tend to see past presidents in the light of our current concerns. So somebody like Andrew Jackson, right, you know, seen historically as a hugely strong president, you know, put him on the $20 bill. And now as we look back at some of his attitudes towards race, towards Native Americans, frankly, towards the banking system generally, in light of efforts to get Alexander Hamilton moved off the $10 bill, people view presidents differently in the light of, again, what we value now.
Yeah. Jim Thurber, any thoughts about or anything to add about this idea of how the intense coverage of a president over 8 years with social media, et cetera, might change the way legacies are created?
I think there's a great deal of noise that comes from social media in the 24/7 news cycle. There's really not a news cycle. There's a nanosecond cycle these days. And I think that will go to the side when serious historians, political scientists look at a particular president. When we declassify documents also, we look at presidents differently. Historians do. So the evaluation by scholars in the field and evaluations of the public are very different. Let's take, for example, Eisenhower. Eisenhower had classified information to show that we really weren't behind the Soviet Union in the space race. He couldn't talk about it. He was accused by Kennedy, and Kennedy gave a very famous speech saying that, you know, the Soviet Union is in, we're behind in the space race. We need to go to the moon and back in 10 years. He created NASA and, you know, this very popular new policy, all based upon the misperception by people that we were the Soviet Union was way ahead of us. Now, the declassification of those documents around his administration show that we weren't. Also, that the correspondence that Eisenhower had and what happened in the Oval Office show that he was very engaged with Congress. He was accused of being sort of a bystander the way Obama is, but he was quite engaged, and he had much more than a hidden hand in trying to get things through Congress. So serious scholarship about presidents is a very important thing to change the view of those presidents also.
And you make a good point here about the disconnect sometimes between the scholarly view of a legacy and the popular one. I remember my parents, my father was a military guy and a Republican, and my mother was a pretty loyal Democrat. And they would argue back and forth often, and it kind of went like this. Well, Nixon lied. And then my father would say, yeah, well, Muskie cried. And this referring to Muskie's reaction to the Canuck letter in the, I think it was the 72 primary. Anyway, he cried or reportedly cried or snow was melting on his cheek. But they had reduced kind of their view of these candidates into this shorthand of, about how they felt about it. It was a very visceral and a very brief one. But do presidents care more about that kind of legacy, or are they more invested in changing the minds of historians or winning over historians and scholars?
You know, I think this is
Jim Thurber.
Yeah,
go ahead. This is Jim Thurber. I think that related to what you're saying is that the nature of communication from a president is very important. If they're charismatic, and Kennedy was, and certainly Obama was in his campaign, and later in the office it was different, that charisma also influences attitudes about presidents. And what happened to them also influences attitudes. The tragic assassination of John F. Kennedy certainly changed the public view about him forever. Even though he didn't pass as much legislation as LBJ, he certainly had a much better reputation than LBJ.
Yeah, I always think about the Kennedy race in 60 against Nixon, and he wins by 1.5-2% of the vote, basically. And about 5 years later, when they're polling Americans, 70% of Americans said they voted for him in 1960, which would have been empirically impossible. So I think what James Thurber is saying is that there is that personal connection, and is when we look at those kind of tragedies, there is such an outpouring of sympathy and understanding of what the kind of sacrifices these people make that certainly helps. I do want to say, though, that when we look at, I mean, I think your question is a good one. Do we care about what kind of decency the man brings or the woman brings to the office? How do people connect with them? And we look at, the sort of mixed record on those issues with something like Bill Clinton. But Bill Clinton's popularity continues to soar because that charisma, that ability to connect with people, really mattered to people. And I think what we see in great politicians is that ability to really find out what the pulse of the crowd is and to reflect that. And people respond to that even greater. And they always tell us, at least when I was running for office, it's your likability, not your brain. And not that the brain isn't important, but go with likability. And I think when we think about that, people connect with that ability to really reflect their values and statements.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, legacies are contested, and presidents certainly do their part to try to shape the way in which we're going to view their administration and their record. Presumably Barack Obama is going to do some of that tonight as he talks about what parts of his record we should pay attention to. Bill Clinton, as Glenn mentioned, he's been doing that for the last 20 years almost. Every Democratic National Convention, he reminds us how great the 1993 to 2000 period was. Well, Donald Trump, as you'll have noticed in the headlines, is trying to remind us of other aspects of that administration.
Nixon especially tried to do that after he left office. He was pushed out of office, and he spent the rest of his life trying to change the perception of his presidency.
Yeah. Jim Thurber, what will we see tonight then? If some of this is an exercise in writing one's own legacy or at least teeing it up, what will we hear, do you think?
Well, I think he's going to talk about his successes. in bringing the economy back from the brink, from 10% to 5% unemployment. He's going to talk about his health care reforms, even though they've been rejected by the Hill, decreasing rise in health costs, expanding health insurance. He passed over 340 bills, became law in his first 2 years, and then we had divided party government. It stopped, but he's going to talk about those things. He promised to get out of two wars. He sort of has done that. He promised to have immigration reform. He's done that through executive order, not as successfully as he wanted to. He promised to have clean up air. He's pushing that with his clean power plan and ozone rules now. He's promised to he promised at the very beginning to reach out to the world and have improve our trade. He's been successful there with the recent Trade Promotion Authority and now the consideration of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which will be a major battle and maybe something where we'll see bipartisanship on the Hill. And he promised to close Guantanamo Bay. I don't know if he'll talk about it, but it's a very tough issue. He may get not booed, but he won't get a lot of applause from the Republicans on that, but he may mention that. He also will try to talk about things that he wants done this next year, and there's very few things that he can get done. But I should mention that in the last Congress, especially in the last 6 months, 18 bipartisan bills passed, some major bills, education reform, the highway bill, which hadn't been passed for many years, since 98. The debt limit ceiling went through, the doc fix. This major education reform didn't get a lot of publicity, but it went through in a bipartisan way. So people criticize him as being a bystander, but he subtly and behind the scenes through surrogates or directly has helped push many of these bipartisan bills, especially in the House, where it's very difficult. So I think he's going to brag about the past, and he's going to talk about what he wants to get done in the future. And it looks tough internationally, and it looks tough in terms of getting the votes in the House of Representatives.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we want to hear from you. It's 800-399-3566, the number 800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by Sweetser, helping children, adults, and families address mental health and substance abuse issues since 1828. Learn more at sweetser.org.
To me, being a gangster was better than being president of the United States.
That's Ray Liotta in Martin Scorsese's film Goodfellas. On the next Fresh Air, Liotta talks about his life and his movies and how he started off playing a nice guy on a soap opera but became known for playing tough guys. Liotta co-stars in the new NBC series Shades of Blue. Join us.
And join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. This Day in Maine is available online at mpbn.net. You can stream it whenever you'd like or take it as a podcast. What is it? This Day in Maine is the day's collection of all the Maine news reporting by the MPBN news staff, all in one place, all at once. What's happening in our state, the day's Maine news, all at once, and it's hosted each evening by MPBN's Barbara Caridi. This Day in Maine is available online each weeknight evening by 7. You can listen to it then or later, the next morning, on the way to work. If Maine is on your mind, This Day in Maine will keep you up to date. It's online at mpbn.net or find us in the iTunes store.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, the legacy of President Obama. With me in our studio, Glenn Cummings, president of the University of Southern Maine and a former member of the Obama administration's education department. Andrew Rudalevich is a professor of government at Bowdoin College, and joining us from Washington, D.C. is American University professor James Thurber. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Glenn Cummings will give you a chance also to talk about maybe what some of the things that the president doesn't point to as some of his achievements that you think will be part of his legacy.
Yeah, I thank you for that. I think Dr. Thurber does a fantastic job of laying out this policy substance of pieces. There are a couple things that I think in his legacy that he won't talk about tonight that are extremely important, I think, for us. I mean, we have, I would say, in this country, no greater scar on the landscape of the American democracy than our history of slavery, our failure to fully implement the civil rights, many of the ideals of the civil rights movement. We have now today the ability for some child who is biracial, who is Afro-American, who can say, I can see the White House and I know it can be done. That is a major change in the history of America. I think the other thing that the president won't talk about today, and maybe I'll be wrong, but also about being scandal-free. I think the last two presidencies we saw some major scandals. He managed to operate a team that avoided those kind of things. Doesn't mean that people agreed with him, but it certainly means that he was able to hold a standard of decency and respect for the Constitution.
Yeah, Andy Rudilevich.
I wanted to mention, again, building on something that Jim mentioned, the role of administrative action and sort of presidential management of the bureaucracy. After those first 2 years of sort of a flurry of substantive legislation, we've had a number of years where that needs to be implemented. And President Obama has tried to do that quite aggressively through regulation, executive memoranda, executive orders, interpretations of past statutes, which naturally enough are interpreted to give him more power rather than less to achieve his preferences. Obviously, I think on the environmental side, that's been one area that's been quite contested, the so-called war on coal, which has resulted in pretty aggressive regulation on the environmental side. But of course, in foreign policy, which we haven't mentioned too much yet, the president has put on what he would consider, I think, firmer legal ground a lot of the initiatives of the Bush administration. We can talk about the legal ground, perhaps not so much today in specific, but there's a lot of attention to the idea that the president's actually expanded some of the unilateral powers of the office with regards to the war on terror, surveillance, the drone war, lots of things that have been quite controversial.
Especially among his core supporters.
Right. Yeah, these are places where he's attacked more from the left than from the right, as is often true on the race issue as well, I would say. Yeah. But one which I think will be pretty consequential in making it sort of safe for future Democratic presidents to act in those ways.
All right, let's go to the phones. We'll bring in Frederick in South Portland. Hi, Frederick.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon, gentlemen. I wanted to build, I think, on what Dr. Cummings had mentioned about more of a moral emphasis of the president. If we look back at the mess, the absolute mess that we had inherited after 8 years of conservative Bush regime with the fiasco in Iraq and then, of course, the banking and lending crisis on Wall Street and the mortgage collapse of the housing industry. Well, President Obama has shown that democracy and governance can be a force for good, can't it? We immediately saw Detroit and the automobile industry rescued. We saw the $900 billion rescue package for the economy, and now Detroit is back on its feet and it's had its best year ever. And in other factors, in other sectors of our society, the president has made an activist approach toward health care, as has been mentioned. The Keystone XL pipeline, as private industry was about to pull the plug on that project, he saw that really there was no moral need for that boondoggle. So I think that his overarching effect for me, and I think for a lot of us, is going to be the fact that he's shown that democracy and governance can indeed be a force for good and for the betterment of our culture and all of us from Main Street. Actually, now to Wall Street, because Wall Street is in now a much better position because of this activist cooperation between government and business.
All right, Frederick, thank you. Let's go to this Wall Street question. What will history say? I realize that's a silly question, but what will history say about how the president kind of shepherded the country out of the financial crisis of 2008? I guess we'll start with you, Glenn.
Well, I guess I would say, first of all, it's interesting that most of his even major shifts in structural public policy initiatives were very conservative, or I would say pragmatic, in the way they were implemented. And what I mean by that is that, you know, he could have done a much more radical view, a New Deal kind of view of how he would have handled Wall Street. He did not. You know, he hires Tim Gentner, the Wall Street insider, to basically shepherd us out of this path. He uses a very conservative approach. Even the ACA, which, you know, no conservative would say it was a conservative approach, but it really was a market-based approach. And he uses very pragmatic approaches to how he wants to handle foreign policy, even, you know, trying to use drones so that he doesn't have the public controversy, perhaps, of the sacrifice of our soldiers and at the highest possible level. So I think when we look at him, we see a very much of a realist, a very, very pragmatic point of view. And I think he felt that undermining Wall Street in a really vulnerable time and trying to recover was not the right approach. That did not always make him popular on the left.
Yeah. Jim Thurber, will the president get credit for helping the nation, guiding the nation into recovery?
I think eventually he will. But it's strange when you hear the Republicans talk about what they can do about the economy, because we've gone from 10% to 5%. We have the lowest inflation. We've sold more trucks and cars in the United States for decades. He did this through action with the stimulus package, with implementation of TARP, which helped banks, GM. He did it through Dodd-Frank and the promulgation of rules and regulations associated with Dodd-Frank re-regulation of the banks and financial institutions, which is still going on. He will be criticized, though, I think, for a while, for being too close to Wall Street, too close to the banks with respect to this regulation and where the money was invested to pull us out. I'd like to go back to a statement that Glenn made, that it was scandal-free, this administration, and it's very important, because in his election, he said he was going to pass the most wide-sweeping ethics reform of any president. I doubt that, but he did, in his first executive order, change the tone of people coming into office. He had tougher rules against revolving door of lobbyists coming in, and lobbyists, and also officials going out of government. He centralized ethics and lobbying reform information. He did this through TARP and stimulus package, but generally, and it set a whole new tone. And I think it kept the administration from having a major scandal, and that's very important.
Andy.
Well, that said, there have been obviously some administrative issues, President Obama came into office not really having been a manager of a large executive organization, in the Veterans Administration and the IRS. The questions of Benghazi continue to circulate, obviously pushed by various agendas. But so I don't know if scandal-free, maybe certainly at the White House level, though actually to say that suggests that the president wasn't always aware of what was going on in the lower reaches of the administration, and that's something to point out. I did want to note, I mean, there's a lot of folks out there who would suggest that the activist government has been less moral, perhaps, or less of a good anyway, than some might suggest. Certainly the Tea Party movement, which arose in opposition to what they saw as effectively an immoral takeover of private life by big government. But look, too, with the Democratic primary, certainly Senator Sanders, but Senator/Secretary Clinton as well, has sort of moved left in terms of, trying to attack the Obama administration for not being activist enough. And so if that's the direction the Democratic Party has gone, that will be an uneasy legacy for the president.
All right, let's go to
Andy.
Yeah.
Andy, on scandal, there are policy controversies, and there are failures in the field, like Benghazi or maybe now in Syria and Iraq. But by scandals, I mean conflict of interest, people getting in trouble in the administration for not pursuing the public good. Now, there have been a few things, like procurement issues for the Boeing aircraft and a procurement officer in DOD and VA problems. But I think the administration's moved very quickly on those things. And I would set them aside from the issue of major policy failures or questions in the field.
All right, let's go to Larry in Bangor. Hi, Larry.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I might be long-winded. I'm sure you'll cut me off. But we president started with two wars, an economy that had lost more jobs than it had gained, was in bad shape. And I think most importantly, he started on the second day, Senator McConnell gathered all the Republicans together, remembering that President Clinton got a lot of credit for a lot of Republican ideas. He told them that I don't care what he's for, we are against it. So he's been fighting an uphill battle since the day he started, and I think he's done a pretty good job. The job growth is, 700,000 or 7 million jobs, something like that. And he had a lot of help from the Federal Reserve in bringing back the economy. But I think no president has been vilified as much as he in such a broad way. Obviously, we now have the ability to listen to our own news rather than what is the news. We can listen to Fox Radio or we can listen to CNN. But I don't think anyone's been vilified as strongly as he, and having done nothing, to bring about the vilification. Obviously, that's my opinion, but I guess I'll wait for your reply.
Okay. Anyone want to weigh in on Larry's?
Sure.
Larry's take?
I'd like to say that I would add to it that he did fairly well in the first 2 years, but when 87 new Republicans came in the 2010 election, and we had divided party government, things stopped. And he had to use executive actions, which are controversial for expanding the power of the president, on his own to pursue certain things that we've talked about. But the polarization and gridlock in Congress, but also in the media and with the voters, has fundamentally influenced his ability to push items on his agenda. Now, also, this is sensitive, but he's the first African-American elected president of the United States. Now, the polls show that there's a certain amount of racism with respect to that, and that's made it very difficult for him also, in my opinion.
I will add, too, that when we look at what many people would argue is his sort of signature piece of policy, which is the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, we see that in that incredible political decision to go all the way. Now I was in the administration at this time, and I can remember that night that was passed in the Senate. The ACA was passed in the Senate. We had the vision on the Education Department side that we would have $55 to $60 billion from a change we had in student loans. We were hoping that money would go into community colleges to basically really open the floodgates for many more Americans to enter higher ed. The president, even though Rahm Emanuel and some of his key advisors, Axelrod and David Plouffe, many of them said, "Don't go through the ASA, ACA. Let's pull back and let's just try to cover all children in America. Let's try to do more for veterans." It was the president ultimately who made the decision. We're going to go forward. We're going to go to the wall. We're going to make this happen. This is the moment in history where I can make this happen. I have to say, I think he spent the rest of his 8 years. Paying the mortgage payment on that political decision. It was a tough decision. I think it may have been the right decision. History will have to see what happens. But I have to say that ability to or that impact on his legacy is that he created an attention that has been hard to resolve thereafter.
All right. Diego writes on Facebook, it's far too early to be thinking of legacy. We should first be thinking of what kind of society America is and what we want it to be. In what ways did President Obama try to lead us towards such goals? That is a legitimate question. We'll take up that and your questions as well after a short break. This is Maine Calling. Stay with us.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by Casella, committed to safe, efficient disposal of non-recyclable waste for all 16 Maine counties, Casella, giving resources new life.
Tonight, it's an NPR News special, live coverage of President Obama's final State of the Union address. I'm Audie Cornish. Join me as we hear reaction from Congress, the official Republican response, and in-depth analysis with NPR reporters from the campaign trail in Iowa to the halls of Capitol Hill. It's special coverage of President Obama's last State of the Union address from NPR News.
And you can hear that live coverage tonight beginning at 9 o'clock on MPBN Radio and MPBN Television. And join us at 1 o'clock following Main Calling for the Commonwealth Club of California. Today's speakers are Rick Snyder, Governor of Michigan, and William Clay Ford, Jr., Executive Chairman of Ford Motor Company. The conversation is about business, energy, and innovation. That's the Commonwealth Club of California coming up at 1 o'clock following Main Calling here on MPBN Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Main Calling. Today on the program, how will history judge President Obama? With me in our studio, Andrew Rudalevich. He's the Thomas Brackett Reed Professor of Government at Bowdoin College. Glenn Cummings is President of the University of Southern Maine. He served in President Obama's Education Department as a Deputy Secretary. And joining us from the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C. is James Thurber. He's a Distinguished Professor of Government and the Founder and Director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. Join the conversation. The number is 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to John in Augusta. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you? This is very interesting. And unfortunately, I think President Obama is going to be a victim of a lack of courage of his own conviction. And what I'm is that he always would enumerate the right way to think, but yet then he'd fall away from them, and they never seem to get done. And it's only been in the past year or so that he's followed up on his own convictions. For instance, the registration of weapons and the push to make that
I'm sorry, John. Your cell phone is just breaking up. I can't quite clearly make it out. John was making a case that maybe he had gone back on some of his. Try calling back, John, if you get a better signal. Andy, did you get a sense of?
Yeah, I think there was an idea that President Obama has been emboldened in the last year or so to be more active, and I think the caller suggested more true to his own convictions. It does go back to what we were talking about before the break with regards to the environment in which he's acting, the broader political environment. Certainly, the press, pundits, people on cable TV are very prone to saying, well, if only he cared more, if only he was a better leader, if only he was schmoozing Congress. Lyndon Johnson comes up a lot, the whole idea of the Johnson treatment and effectively bullying Congress to do your will. This is where political scientists tend to diverge pretty significantly in thinking about, again, what are the structural attributes of the political environment a president faces? And given the, as Jim said earlier, the lack of a majority in Congress and certainly the more polarized political parties that we see today, it's hard to imagine he could have moved much further, much faster in a lot of these areas. And perhaps being a lame duck is empowering in some ways, certainly in terms of the moral leadership with regards to inclusiveness, in terms of race, in terms of same-sex issues that we've seen, big changes in the last couple of years. I think that's important.
A caller who couldn't stay on the line wanted to mention that racism is the 500-pound elephant in the room. But also to an earlier comment that really this legacy will be about an effort to change American culture in some ways, that the president would be seen as leading over a transition, over a change in a time in America, Glenn Cummings. Is there anything to that, or is it too hard to focus on as we're right on top of it?
It's a little hard to see right from the hill that we're on, but I'm sure from the mountains of the future we'll be able to look at that a little bit better. I think you're going to see that the initial impression is he could have stood taller, he could have pushed more radical change. I don't think that's his temperament. I knew him a little bit personally, and to that extent he is a thoughtful, very pragmatic person. I don't think he's as bold and as radicalized as perhaps his critics have made him by any means. I think more importantly, as we look into the future, I think we'll see that somehow his candidacy, I think there's a poignant connection between his presidency and the fact that so much racial discussion has occurred certainly in the last 5 years. And so much of that has begun to say the gap between the reality and our ideals is so large that the anger is beginning to come up in ways that it hasn't for a couple decades here in the country. I think you're going to start to see more and more people look at that legacy and say he was a major contributor to our change in how we look at ourselves, certainly in gay marriage, and certainly in race relations, and certainly even in our public policy and our foreign policy and how we look at ourselves.
Yeah. Jim Thurber, you articulated many of the accomplishments and the specifics, but are there some larger themes as we're talking about here about maybe the president's role as leader in a time of transition?
Well, there's the domestic issues and there's the international and defense issues. He's pushed for immigration reform and really failed. He had to take executive action to move that area. He promised to have a pathway to citizenship and secure borders. We certainly seem to have secure borders. The pathway to citizenship is not there. He also signed the Lilly Ledbetter Act, which means equal pay for women for their activities. It's not fully implemented, but he took executive action on that with the executive branch and contractors, which has helped. Healthcare is going to be a major issue going forward in terms of quality, cost, finance, and access. And he made major progress in that area with the ACA. But remember, he also pushed SCHIP, which is a children's health insurance program, which was rejected. It was vetoed by George W. Bush. It was one of the first things that he passed, and it's very important to poor children in America. He also is pushing against all kinds of well-organized groups, especially the NRA, on background checks on gun control. He's doing what he can do. He's not getting away from some of the major controversial issues in America. Now, when it comes to foreign policy, he promised to shut down two wars. He has to a certain extent, but they are not easy things to do. He promised to take all the prisoners out of Guantanamo. That's been very difficult because of actions from the Hill and other reasons, like countries don't want to take their people back that are there. He has had major issues with respect to Syria, with respect to Putin and Ukraine, Libya. These things are not easily controlled. Where he is making some success is, and it may be a major part of his legacy, is in trade. It was a miracle that the Trade Promotion Authority passed. It passed by 218 votes, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this big trade deal with 11 other nations that's coming up, it looks like it's going to be bipartisan, but it's going to be very hard to get through. If that goes through, that'll be part of, a serious part of his legacy.
I think in foreign policy, where he really does push the edge, is setting a tone for that the President of the United States will negotiate with people who have been traditional enemies. And his belief is that, you know, it's a very democratic, a small d democratic belief, that you can work with people and you can make agreements that work. And certainly the nuclear arms agreement with Iran underscores some of his belief system. The first thing he does is he goes to the Arab world when he's elected and he says, you know, there are lots that we have in common. Let's work together. I think that idealism matched with the pragmatism is, I think, a feather in his cap in terms of foreign policy.
On the issue of
Glenn, I would add to that the Paris Climate Accord and also the U.S.-Cuba agreements opening up Cuba as well as TPP. All of those things are important, and it shows leadership on his part.
Yeah, I'd say perhaps these gentlemen are being a little kind, though. You know, one of the problems with any president working in foreign policy is you're working with other people who have, you know, different interests than you do, and so you're a little bit dependent for your success on their not necessarily their goodwill, but in making sure that you can get their interests to align with yours. And so, you know, with regards to Iran, for example, I mean, we're going to be pretty dependent on the enforcement framework that's been set up actually working. And obviously, there's a lot of skepticism about that. You look at Syria and the legacy so far of the Arab Spring, not altogether positive.
Well, this is where history comes in, as we said at the top. For example, in the Affordable Care Act, if it turns out to be one of the most transformative steps in changing the way that health care, in fact, the way that Americans view health care, it will be the legacy will be seen as something incredible and transformative.
If it stumbles and is gutted and is replaced by something else, it will look as if it's something completely different. And I guess this goes back to, time will tell what the legacy is on some of these things. Go ahead.
Yeah, one thing that has not been mentioned, it's like the 500-pound elephant in the room, and that is we had a deficit of $1.3 trillion when he came in, and it's now $439 billion. It's gone down dramatically. So not only the economy has improved, but the deficit has gone down and not been a major issue that it was before he was elected.
Let's go to Beverly in Belfast really quickly, Beverly, if you could, please.
Thank you. I agree with previous callers on the racism part. I feel that McConnell's comment as soon as he was elected was a horrible one for the state of Kentucky, and that was my first goal is to make this a first-term president or a one-term president. That was a horrible thing for him to say. To my point, I'm interested in how your guests would respond to the lack of dialogue that exists between Republicans and Democrats right now. I'm old enough to remember a time when you actually learned something from listening to the various arguments regarding these incredibly complex issues like climate change and gun control. And, these one-word answers like Second Amendment, period, or it's just so horribly simplified that it's putting us into a dangerous state because we're like the Patriots playing the Jets or something. It's not about intelligent people anymore. I'm just wondering how you would comment on that.
Well, Nixon lied, Muskie cried. It hasn't changed.
So,
but, yeah, go ahead.
I would say that structurally and politically we have a sorted and polarized voters. We've got polarized media. We've got polarized state legislatures throughout America. And, of course, we have a polarized Congress with only about 4% of the members of the House and the Senate vote together. There's this thing called the common vote analysis, which shows you how many people are in the middle. It used to be about one-third in the late 60s and 70s where people got together, they talked with each other, they were civil. Now we have warfare. We have tribal warfare going on the Hill, but it's reinforced by what's going on in society. That makes it very difficult. He's pushing against that. And this last year, amazingly, there were, as I mentioned, 18 major pieces of legislation that passed in a bipartisan way where the Republicans had to reach over and have a significant number of Democrats, and he was part of that quietly.
Yeah. Glenn?
Well, it's interesting for me to spend a couple of years in Washington after being almost 10 years in the legislature here, and I thought, wow, you know, what kind of partisan here in the legislature? I went down there, and I said, wow, we really have it good in Maine. We've done a great job. We pass all our budgets almost always with two-thirds vote. So I have to say, I'm not on the inside down in Washington by any means. I have to say that it seems like the visceral negativity that has characterized Washington in the last 10 or 15 years really put our country into a stalemate.
Yeah, I think there's a structural question here that arises from the Constitution, the idea that the president is responsible for a national viewpoint, whereas members of Congress are elected locally. And to the extent that local constituencies are polarized as well, you're going to wind up with members of Congress who really have no electoral interest. And that's pretty high on their agendas, no electoral interest in supporting the president. So I think there's certainly, it's hard ever to dismiss questions of race in America, but opposition to the president was overdetermined in many ways. There are lots of reasons for opponents of the president to oppose him.
Yeah. So your 15-second Obama legacy statement. We'll start with you, Glenn.
I think it's going to be very positive. I think history will tend to look very positively, not only in what he brought to the White House as a man, but what he brought in terms of policy under incredibly difficult situations, particularly fiscally, brought us back to a good place. And I think that his decency will prevail and how people connect with him over the next generations.
Andy Rudilevich?
I would say that the legacy will remain somewhat polarizing, that there will be people who resent his actions and people who applaud it. That will vary quite a lot by one's affiliation with a political party, but I think no one will be able to deny that he had a consequential impact on American politics long term.
Jim Thurber?
I think he'll go down in history, obviously, as the first African-American president. That's very important. People don't talk about it very much. They take it for granted, certainly around the world and here. That was very important. But I think he'll be known for bringing our economy back to a healthy state. But also, I think he'll be known for healthcare policy. I think that the ACA will continue to struggle, but it will survive, and he'll be known for that.
James, Andrew, Glenn, thank you all for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
James Thurber is a distinguished professor of government and founder and director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. He is the author of numerous books, his most recent, American Gridlock, The Sources, Character, and Impact of Political Polarization. Andrew Rudalevich is the Thomas Brackett Reed Professor of Government at Bowdoin College. And Glenn Cummings, the president of the University of Southern Maine, and he served in President Obama's Education Department as a deputy secretary. John Keimel ran the board today. And, of course, remember, you can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mainecalling.net. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at midnight. The executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. Tomorrow on the program, join host Jennifer Rooks for a conversation about the effects of alcohol on our health. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.